Hello, and welcome to Sesquicentennial Stories, a deep dive into the history of Alaska before, during, and after the Alaska Purchase in 1867. Our goal is to tell the story of the 49th state from as many viewpoints as possible, presenting you with some twists on stories you know, and hopefully learning something new along the way. This series is sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and our topic today is, what is the best way to approach uncomfortable history? When we decided to do this series, we were careful to be respectful of all viewpoints and backgrounds, but there is no perfect way to commemorate the sesquicentennial. There's simply too much uncomfortable history. In the first of a two-part episode, I spoke to Alaskan historian and author Ross Cohen. What I like most about your work is that you're approaching Alaskan history from many different angles and finding sort of some deeper stories. But I can guess that within your work, there are times when you come across some history that it's going to be uncomfortable for people to learn about, discover, revisit. How, as a historian, how do you approach uncomfortable history?
Well, you know, the job of a historian is really to understand the past in all of its complexity. There's a novelist who once said that the past is a foreign country. People did things differently there. And that's really a great way of looking at it. When we look at actors in the past and events in the past, we often fall into this trap of assuming that people in the past are just like us, that they think the way we do, that they talk the way we do, that they live their lives by the same morality and ethics and guidelines that we do. And that's really not the case at all. Anyone in the past, wherever they live, whatever era they're in, they're making decisions about their lives according to the mores of the time, the economic circumstances that they find themselves in, the political climate of the region and the era. And so when we study the past, we need to understand the decisions and the actions of people within their context, not as it compares to ours, but as a standalone entity that made sense for them at the time. And we run into this very often when we encounter exactly the things that you're talking about. How do we respond when people of an earlier era used racial epithets, for example? They referred to Alaska Natives, for example, by all manner of names that were acceptable at the time, but today we read those and we wince because of how outdated and how characteristic of oppression those names are. So it is a real trick for a historian to tell those uncomfortable stories and to do so in a way that is not going to belittle or marginalize peoples of today. Now, that's not really an answer to your question. How do we do that? And I'm not sure I even have a good answer, but it's something that historians constantly have to be aware of in their work. And it requires just an ongoing dialogue with the general public to understand the way that people behaved in the past.
Think about your answer. I get it, but I also think about, where is that line where we're sort of excusing that person? Maybe I'm wrong, but I think about our founding fathers who owned slaves, and sometimes, right. and you're like, well, you know, back in the day, things were different. People just owned slaves, but they were abolitionists at that same time. Where is that line where you can no longer excuse people from the past? I don't know what the answer is, or if there is an answer, or like a clean answer.
I think I might characterize it a little bit differently, though, to say that, you know, the historian's purpose is not to judge people of the past. It's not to make excuses for their behavior or absolve them, you know, for this set of misdeeds because they were a good person in every other respect. The historian's job is really just to recapture the past and present it in all of its complexity and all of its contradictions. I see what you're saying, and it's a natural impulse, I think, to want to judge these characters for their failings, like the founding fathers for owning slaves, for example. That's really tricky territory, and I don't know that there is an easy answer or an easy solution to it, other than the fact that more dialogue about these issues is always better than less. I'm absolutely not in favor of censorship in any regard. You know, your listeners might remember or might be aware that every now and then there's a debate about Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn by Mark Twain, you know, for the words that are used to describe Jim, right? The N-word and specifically. And every now and then there are efforts to maybe republish those books but take out that word. I don't think that's a solution at all. I think we are much better off dealing with these difficult, painful issues by confronting them head on rather than trying to scrub the historical record of all mentions and pretend that that word never existed. I don't think that's a solution at all.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I also think that doing that type of work also gives sort of this negative power to the word that they, you know, words or phrases, you know, that they don't necessarily deserve or should have. And,
yeah.
And you know, put a,
I agree.
They need to be put in the right place. Have you received any sort of backlash for some of the work that you've done?
Oh, sure. You know, one of the examples I actually like to talk about, this is a story that I reference often. I did a lot of writing on Alaska statehood. I wrote an article in which I pointed out, yes, Alaska statehood has been successful in many ways, and I'm very happy to live here. I'm proud of, you know, those who wrote the Constitution and who helped Alaska to become a state. But let's not lose sight of the fact that there are, you know, at the time that statehood was being debated in the 1950s, there were a lot of arguments against it. I was doing my writing about statehood, and I talked about some of these arguments against statehood and how those arguments are still in circulation in different forms. I was doing a talk, a public lecture one time, and I won't say where because I don't want to embarrass, you know, and I'm not going to name any individuals. My goal here is not to embarrass anyone. But the mayor of the town at the end of my lecture stood up and he said, "It sounds like you're trying to, you know, do some revisionist history here and you know, tell us that, you know, statehood was not a good thing and that we made, you know, pointing out all the mistakes that we've made." And he closed by saying, "Ross, how long have you lived in Alaska?" And I think that is just absolutely brilliant. I wasn't offended at all, and I'm so glad that he said it. Because Alaska is one of these curious places where the longer you've lived here, the greater authority you are, presumably, to speak on behalf of Alaska. And the fact that at that time I had lived in Alaska for, I don't know, 21 years, but he had been here for 37 years, meant that he understood these issues better than I did, right? You know, you see this every day in the newspaper when people sign their letters to the editor, "I have lived in Alaska for 63 years. And they say that as a credential, that that means their words are to be taken seriously, right? So that's just one example of how sometimes bringing up the complicated nature of our history results in pushback from people who like the history that they've been told. They like their story and the view and the feel that they have about Alaska, and they don't want anyone to come along with inconvenient facts that challenge that view.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, brought to you by the Sitka Historical Society and Sitka History Museum. I'm talking to historian Ross Cohen, and I asked him about the inherent difficulties in finding a way to commemorate the sesquicentennial.
How do we commemorate or even celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Alaska Purchase, 1867, in a way that includes everyone in that story? It's a very difficult thing because often with regard to these types of historical anniversaries, we are treated to what I sometimes refer to as the Chamber of Commerce version of history. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I have nothing against chambers of commerce. But typically, you know, a city's leaders, the business elite, are very fond of these triumphant histories that celebrate our past, you know, that show what a marvelous success Alaska has been, and here are the historical antecedents that brought us to this pinnacle of civilization that we occupy today. That's a very popular sort of easy tourist-friendly version of history that you see almost everywhere. This is not merely an Alaska phenomenon. You see it around the world. I think it's vital, however, particularly now when we're looking back on 150 years of the American period of Alaska history, that we recognize this is not a rising tide that has lifted all boats. And in fact, there are peoples who, throughout the 150 years, who have not fared as well, who have even suffered perhaps for it. And to simply say, well, you know, Alaska Native peoples, they're certainly better off under American rule than they would have been under Russian rule had Russia not sold Alaska. Well, sure, that's true, but that's a historical what if. And that to me is not that to me is not a very solid argument, right? I mean, if I punch you in the arm as opposed to the kidney, you shouldn't be grateful of the fact that I punched you in the arm because it does no lasting damage, whereas a blow to the kidney actually could. Hey, you're still getting punched. There is no denying the fact that for years, decades after the purchase, they were treated abominably by the Americans, forced into boarding schools and forced into, you know, missionaries, or not forced, coerced is perhaps a better word, made to renounce their tribal ways and their language. I mean, there's a really devastating legacy of this colonialism, and I think colonialism is an appropriate word in this context. So to come back to your question then, how do we celebrate the sesquicentennial? I think there are many ways to do it, and we can certainly tell these triumphant stories about William Seward and his vision for Alaska and for America, and you know, what a marvelous success it has been for many people. That should not, however, prevent us from telling stories about the boarding schools and about how certain people, particularly Alaska Natives and other minorities, have suffered, how they were, you know, denied opportunities to participate in the economic and political life of Alaska, really until the recent decades. So again, this comes back to the point I think I've been making all along here, is that history is very complex, very contradictory, and we are better for it if we can confront history with all of that complexity, warts and all. Not to pass judgment, not to suggest that anyone is to blame for anything, but simply to acknowledge everything, every part of our past. Because let's face it, we live with the legacy of the past every single day. It's very often comforting to say, yeah, that was in the past, there's nothing we can do to change it, let's just move on. Well, I don't think we can actually do that, because we live with the legacy of those past wrongs and those past rights every single day. We should not just move on. We should acknowledge it and then move forward, not ignoring those parts of our past, but rather embracing them and incorporating them into the story that we tell about ourselves.
You've been listening to Sesquicentennial Stories with historian and author Ross Cohen. In part two of Approaching Uncomfortable History, we'll talk to Tlingit Nation member David Kanash. This series is sponsored by the Sitka History Museum and the Sitka Historical Society, with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Sitka Legacy Fund, and KCW Sitka. This series is produced by Mission Man Media. Jeff Budd is the executive producer. I'm Emmett Williams, and thanks for listening.